Blog Talk Radio.
People make the world go round.
Be your host. Our guest tonight is Mr. Holder, Lawrence Holder.
Hi, Rodney.
Hi, Mr. Holder. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, thank you.
Very good. We're glad to have you on the show.
I appreciate being on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, I wanted to give our audience a little background about yourself.
A little background, huh? All right, I'm about 6,500 years old, and I've been writing plays for the last 41 years. I had my first professional production at La Mama in 1978. That was about 9 years after I started writing. It was a musical called Juba, and it was about the black American dancer, Freed Blackman, who came to New York City, the Five Points area. And had a good time.
Okay. Well, thank you.
In terms of coming to fame, he became known as the king of all dances. He out-Irished jigged the Irish people.
Oh, God.
One guy named Jack Diamond.
So, I guess we would like to talk about your play tonight. Particularly, mm-hmm. We'd like to talk about, since it's tonight is Malcolm X's birthday, we'd like to kind of.
When the Chickens Came Home to Roost.
Okay.
That was a play that I wrote in 1981, and Woody King and the New Federal Theater produced it, and we had the good fortune to have Kirk Kirksey portraying Elijah Muhammad, who was the founder of the National, what do they call them? The Nation of Islam. Gee, my memory is really... I told you I was 65,000 years old. And, of course, Denzel Washington is Malcolm X. That was the first time he fielded that character. He was excellent. And Denzel himself, of course, has gone on to far more wealthy things.
Right. Could you give us a little bit of insight on what prompted you to write the play?
Well, actually, Woody King asked me to write the play. Asked me to write a two-character play for Kirk Kirksey. Kirk and I were very good friends. I had no problems wanting to do that. And, of course, Malcolm X was one of the great icons. And maybe because I wasn't as close to him as so many other people, gave me an opportunity to see him more clearly for a stage production. because I didn't walk around with any bias. And as I remember it at the time, I was thinking that the more important person was Elijah Muhammad, because he gave voice to Denzel Washington. I mean, to Malcolm X. Jesus, God. Denzel is not Malcolm, but he comes close.
Now, so how did you learn about Malcolm? And
oh, no, well, I read the autobiography that he put together with Alex Haley, and, of course, there were some private books that he had. Malcolm X Speaks is the title, I remember. And there were a couple of other big speeches of his. So, you know, you can find out who he is by reading him. So, shall we go on to Zora? Oh, no, we're still on Malcolm X's birthday. What else you want to know about Malcolm?
Well, you know, we wanted to give our audience a good background about, like we could say, probably the climate of Malcolm in terms of his relationship, his transformations and all, basically, as far as him being involved with the Nation and mm-hmm. some of his things as he moved along in his career. So we want to get
all right, well, let's start with the fact that he was arrested, and I believe he was arrested and imprisoned in 1947, I believe. Might have been earlier. And then he was released in 52, might have been earlier. I think he spent about 5 years in jail. And I also think he spent those years in jail because he was a drug pusher. And he was at that time known as Detroit Red. As a child, he had witnessed his father being assassinated by segregationists, Ku Klux Klanners. So he, from the beginning, the get-go, he had the energy inside of him to want to resist the strictures of segregation and colonization and all. But, you know, he got swept up into the drug world, became known as Detroit Red, ran a lot, did a lot of stuff in Harlem, what have you, and then he was popped. I believe it was in Boston. And while in jail, his brother came to him, Reginald. And Reginald Little, because Malcolm's real name was Malcolm Little, Reginald Little, his brother, introduced him to the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, with basically the promise that Elijah would free him if he were to follow him. At the same time that Malcolm X is doing that, he is also reading, learning to read. He's reading the dictionary. And I believe he started from Z and worked his way forward, backwards. But it may have been the other way around. He started with A and worked his way to Z. But he was reading and learning the language through the dictionary. Upon his release, he is admitted as a member of the Nation of Islam, and he works very, very hard. He really gives himself over to it. I believe the Nation of Islam helped him negotiate meeting Betty Shabazz, and he and Betty Shabazz hit it off. And she was probably the most significant human being in his life, you know, once he realizes maturity. And well, I'll tell you about the ending of Betty Shabazz to the extent that I know of it. But anyway, Malcolm moved from city to city to city, trying to develop mosques, bringing black consciousness to the masses of Americans, but of course specifically to black Americans, and with a real eye towards getting people to join the Nation of Islam. Some of you might know the Nation of Islam from its warrior group, which is called the Fruit of Islam. These very finely dressed, militaristic gentlemen who help maintain order in some of our really lousy neighborhoods, in fact. But, you know, Malcolm X, you know, worked very hard. He helped expand the Nation of Islam from one or two mosques to seven or eight mosques, and he certainly brought consciousness to the entire country. And what's his name? Elijah Muhammad made him the national spokesperson for the nation, recognizing in Malcolm X a man truly dedicated to the cause.
Now, I noticed that at some point in his journey with the nation, there came to a point where he had some confrontations. I know there was one particular scene with the where Malcolm X knocked on Elijah Muhammad's door, and there was a confrontation. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know about that specific confrontation, but what I can tell you is the fact that because of Malcolm's total devotion and dedication, that all of the other ministers, including Minister Farrakhan, seemed to resent, I won't say they were jealous, but they seemed to resent all that he was doing. And he became very, what's the word I'm looking for? He became very
popular
with the masses, but the spokespeople were having a hard time with him.
Now,
I don't know about that incident. I don't know about this incident about him knocking on the door. Oh, that's not a confrontation. But okay, here's what happened. Malcolm X found out that Elijah Muhammad was having affairs with secretaries that he himself was hiring. Not only was he having affairs with them, but he was getting them pregnant. And after getting them pregnant, then he would have them kicked out of the movement. And when this came to the attention of Malcolm X, he's really Mr. Pureheart, he brought the information to the attention of Elijah Muhammad. And that's the knocking on the door incident of the play, which in essence began a version of the play, certainly the version we did in 1981. It kind of begins with Elijah Muhammad pacing back and forth, waiting for Malcolm X to show up, and then there's a knock on the door, and the door opens, and Denzel, as Malcolm steps in, and the whole audience gasps because he looks so like Malcolm X, and then the play is off and running. And essentially it deals with the fact that, you know, Malcolm was very, very pure, and Elijah, although pure, was an older man and given to some of his predilections of, you know, looking at the women and wanting to flirt and play with them. And, of course, the women themselves helped encourage it because he was the leader of the nation, so they wanted to do everything right and everything nice for the leader. So he kind of, I think, in my estimation, he kind of got caught up in all of that. And if a woman throws herself into your lap, what does a man do? Rodney, tell me, what does a man do when that happens? You wouldn't know, I know.
Now, a lot that our audience needs to learn about Mr. Malcolm Little became Malcolm X with the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
One part of that you've touched upon is his devotion to the Nation of Islam. But there came a point in his time where he took a trip to Mecca and with his Hajj. And I'd like the audience to pretty much get an idea of how that shaped before he went to the Hajj in Mecca, and when he returned, how he viewed Islam in terms of its religion and the nation. How did he view the two?
While he's dedicated and working with the Nation of Islam, he's a definite segregationist. He's, you know, black power is all about black folks. And what happened to sour that was the fact that President Kennedy was assassinated. And with that assassination, Elijah Muhammad sent out a series of directives to all of his ministers asking them or informing them that they should remain silent. Unfortunately, Malcolm X was not silent. And upon his return to the Haven and meeting up again with Elijah Muhammad, he discovered that Elijah Muhammad was going to take it to him. And in fact, he silenced him for 90 days, meaning he could not say anything anywhere about anything for 90 days. But after the 90 days, he still would not admit Malcolm back into his good graces. And, of course, all of that had created severe shock to his system. And with his system being messed up, he began to look outside of the Nation of Islam. He began to look at what black Islam was about, black Muslims were about. And he made this Hajj so that he could find out more about Islam. When he made the Hajj, he discovered that white people, brown people, black people, So anyway, that's what went down.
So did it feel to change his insight on, particularly in the 60s, it had a lot of race relations were at a heightened point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, as they are now. They're just not being recorded properly.
Now, did it change his in how he dealt with the masses of white people and of different races, basically in his trip to Mecca? Did he have a more, I guess you could say, a lot of people when they look at Malcolm, they think of him as being, you know, a rebel in the sense that he didn't like other people, and you know, with the nation, a lot of times they talked about blue-eyed devils and different things of that nature. But after his trip to actually Mecca and all, he came to work with a lot of different races, which a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah, well, they don't realize it because this country has made it its business to keep people from knowing the whole truth.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's rather keep people ignorant or, you know, give them partial truths rather than whole truths. So, boom.
All right. Well, we got a good idea of Mr. Malcolm X's background. Now, let's give you a little bit of background what prompted you to write about black history.
Well, you know, I think it was my mother that kind of foisted that on to me. You know, she kept putting historical things in front of me, and so I would go for it. And,
so was your child?
The first
child
thing was that Juba project that I mentioned to you, but then after we had a little success with that, I started to see the value of bringing to the attention of our community, if nowhere else, the notion that, you know, black people had much to contribute, have been contributing, and will continue to be contributing to humankind.
Now, what exactly is Juba?
Juba is a dance. It is also the name of the person who gives the dance its name. So, that's Juba.
Now, this was in you learned about Juba in your childhood?
I learned about Juba in 1976. I actually went to the library, I went to Schomburg, I went all over the place. Very little information about him, so I had to create this phantasmagoria. But we do know that his real name was William Henry Lane. We know that he comes from Rhode Island. We knew that he was a freedman, and he came to fame in an area, Lower East Side, called Five Points, which is essentially the Wall Street area.
Okay. All right. Now, I know you wrote some other plays that you work with. I guess it's a play about Zora.
Yes, I've written five plays about Zora Neale Hurston. And what can I say? I love her very much because she is she has the spirit that I think all human beings have, but human beings submerge it or mute it. And I think that because of the things that were attacking her, she's coming through in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. She dies in 1960.
Now, we have to give our audience a full scope of who Ms. Zora Neale Hurston is.
All right, well, she's a great folklorist. She wrote Mule Bone with Langston Hughes, which is a play. She wrote Tell My Horse, and there's another title that just eludes me right now. And she's also one of the finest novelists of all time. And her greatest novel is Their Eyes Were Watching God. And that was published in 1934 by Lippincott. It was Lippincott, yeah.
Now, she
dies in 1960. Penniless, broke. She was accused of sodomizing a 10-year-old boy. She tried to fight the charges. The black newspapers were running with that information. The white newspapers stood on the sidelines and said and did nothing. So,
now, what was her relationship with Langston Hughes and Richard?
Well, they were creative collaborators. I wrote a play called Zora and Langston. We did it in 1998 or 99 at Theater for the New City. And it starred my wife, Andrea Holder, as Zora. And people really like her as Zora. But at any rate, you know, Zora and Langston had a falling out. Their falling out was basically on a creative basis, where she took exception to the fact that Langston Hughes, for some strange reason, gave a typist 1/3 credit for the creation of the play. And she said, why? Well, she is a typist. Why does she get credit for that? So, and me being who I am, that definitely touches me. Definitely in touch. Enchanted Caribbean Paradise. So anyway, that's Laura Neale Hurston. I've also written a play called Red Channels, which is the impact of McCarthyism and the Red Scare on people like Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and a composite black actor. I forget what we call him, but he had a name. I just can't think of his name off the top of my head. All these books, by the way, can be found at AuthorHouse.com, AuthorHouse.com. My name is Lawrence Holder. I don't know why I'm selling myself at this particular moment, but I am. And boom, boom, boom. So you can get those books, Renaissance Women, Renaissance Men 1, Renaissance Men 2, Renaissance Solos, and Renaissance Collection.
Now, you have a current project that's
going on. Oh, my website. Yes, and my website. I'm being prompted here. I'm really slow on the uptake. My website is lawrenceholder.com. And Lawrence is spelled with a U. Yeah, don't email me. I got enough emails. I had 109 emails this morning. I don't need 109 anything. Except thousands of dollars. Rodney, where are you, baby?
I'm right here. I'm
there
just listening to you on here. I'm still on here.
Okay. Another play that I've written, as a matter of fact, I've written three plays about these guys, Monk and Bud.
Okay.
Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell.
Now, I want to know some we have some information. I saw some advertisements before, as you have another play or project that was going on with Dr. May Chen.
Yes, the name of that play is Dr. May Edward Chin, and it's down at the Richard Allen Center for Culture and Art at 40 Peck Slip, which is right off South Street, and it's only about two blocks north of Fulton Street. And this is last weekend.
Now, could we get a little background on Dr. May Chin, what her life was about, and her relations to inspiring to be involved with writing the play.
You got the same cues? Yes, May Chin was the first female practicing doctor in Harlem for many years. And she became very, very instrumental in the treatment of cancer. And she was one of the first people to even put her finger on, this is a cancer. And so she's very significant because, as you might imagine, breast cancer affects black women more than it affects other women. Prostate cancer affects black men more than it does other men, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She was very, very important. Important figure, local figure, very important.
Now, how did that become something that she put a finger on in that time? Cancer?
Well, you know, she was you want me to tell you the play?
No,
she
no,
dropped out of school. She dropped out of school, never finished high school. Okay, never finished high school. And then a friend of hers said, you know, you're so smart, you're so bright, why don't you take the nursing exam or a doctor's exam to get into one of the medical schools. She took it. She scored so highly, they brought her in to talk to her because they noted she didn't have a high school diploma. And she impressed them thoroughly, so they all went crazy over her. And she wound up getting her medical degree, much to the amusement of her mother and father.
Now, see, also, what was her relationship to Mr. Paul Robeson?
Yes, that was the thing that initially attracted me to writing about her. She was the accompanist to Paul Robeson before Lawrence Brown, who was his main accompanist. And I think she was with him for about 4 or 5 years.
Now, what did she accompany? What instrument or all did she?
She was a piano. She self-taught herself piano. She played piano. You know all of these things. Why don't you just tell the people?
No, I don't want to tell the audience. You're my person that I want to speak to regarding Dr. May Chin, and we want to, you know, elaborate on all of your great works that you've been involved with. And
we just did, Richard.
Yeah.
Red Channels was that Red Scare play with Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois. I thought I mentioned that.
What exactly is that, the Red Scare and the Red Channel?
Oh, the Red Scare. The Red Scare is when the country all of a sudden, after World War II, decided that its ally, Russia, or the USSR, as it was known then, would be its enemy. So they had this Cold War. And the Cold War was just that. And they arrested people, threw them in jail. They arrested W.E.B. Du Bois, who was 80 years old at the time. They arrested him at Dulles Airport, handcuffed him publicly. This is an 80-year-old man. And at 80, you can barely make the stairs, you know what I mean? So the fact that they would handcuff him and try to humiliate and embarrass him is just another testament to some of the attitudes that we have in this country.
Now, who is Mr. Du Bois that they would give him such attention?
Well, Du Bois was a social activist. He just refused to let America off the hook. He would not let them just practice their segregation. He was the one of the founding members of the NAACP in 1904, 05, 09. He was the founder of the Crisis magazine, which, in fact, helped identify people like Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes and other great writers, County Cullen, you name it. On a bulletin, you name it. W.E.B. Du Bois is the guy who wrote the transatlantic slave trade in German, getting his Ph.D. from the University of Heidelberg, if I remember it correctly, okay? In German, I might add. So Du Bois was no lightweight, nor was Paul Robeson. For those of our audience who don't know who Paul Robeson was, he was an All-American football player who had his name taken off the All-American rolls because of his social activism. He was about his people. He got a law degree, but did not practice law because they would not let him practice it here in New York. Fortunately, he had so much talent, he became one of the greatest of all concert singers, had a wonderful baritone voice. And if you want to check out Showboat, go check out Old Man River, sung by him. Other people can sing that song, too. But Paul Robeson is a very special cat, as was Du Bois. And those were the two of the leading male protagonists in our fight for equality, which continues, by the way.
Now, we have several people throughout history. Why were they so targeted?
Because they were outspoken. They were vocal. People listened to them.
Now, I guess that we'll move on to, let's talk more about your plays, and you have one.
Winnie Mandela, M. the Mandela Saga. Yeah, that's an interesting take that I had about the Mandela situation. It's a three-character play. The third character, aside from Nelson and Winnie, is a cousin of Nelson, or a cousin of Winnie, one of the, I think it's a cousin of Nelson. His name is Kaiser Mantanzima, something like that. And he worked for the clerk and the guy who came before the clerk. I can't think of the white racist name. But he was instrumental, in fact, in getting Nelson into, what was the name, Robben's Island? And the one before that, Polesmore, into jail. And they were related to each other. One was working for the authorities, the establishment, and the other was a terrorist, because that's what Nelson was, a terrorist, dropping bombs, blowing people up, trying to get attention to the situation of apartheid. Cost him 27 years in jail, and his wife worked her little butt off, or big butt, depends how you look at it, and, kept the name of the ANC and South Africa and apartheid in the minds of people all over the world, so that when he gets out of jail, you would expect a Hollywood ending, right? Husband reunites with wife, and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, as you know from your history, they never got back together again. And my play is all about the fact that they didn't get back together again.
Which is kind of tragic.
And Marjorie Johnson, by the way, gave a stunning performance as Winnie Mandela and won a Best Actress Adelco Award for it. And the play also garnered me, as had When the Chickens Came Home to Roost, garnered me Adelka for writer of the year. Although with Chickens, I was in a tie with Charlie Fuller. Charlie Fuller had I think, Zoo Man and the Sign that year. Charlie Fuller's a great little writer, great big writer. Sorry, Charles. He's taller than me.
Now, this I wanted to ask you. Who is Mrs. Snow? Miss Snow.
Who's Mrs. Who?
Mrs. Snow. Miss Snow.
Oh, Valeda. The
yes.
Great Valeda Snow. Yes. Valeda Snow is a singer, dancer, trumpet player who came to fame in the 20s when Florence Mills was stricken with her appendicitis and came back to the U.S., DEAD. The girl who took over for her, the woman who took over for her, was Valeda Snow, who had a very tight relationship with the producer, Lou Leslie. Valeda was a really good-looking woman on top of all of her talents, and she knocked out, what's his name, Edward Wallace Simpson's man, Edward, and they had to get Valeda out of town because Edward had flipped for Valeda Snow. So they did. They sent her, got her out to the Far East, and she, where she played the trumpet, did her dancing. And she was known as Little Louie, by the way, because she could play the trumpet really well. She owned her own band, had her own band. She's better known in Europe than she is here in the United States. But what attracted me to her was the fact that she spent 18 months in the Nazi concentration camp. So I said, ooh, here's a chance to poke fun at the Nazis, too. So I did.
Now,
she, by the way, when she is repatriated from the Nazi concentration camp back to the United States, she spends the next 10 or so years of her life getting back to Broadway. She gets to it. She gets to the Palace Theater. You've seen it on Broadway and by 52nd Street. She's got a two-week gig. She does three shows a day. And on the last show, she has a massive heart attack and dies. Now, you talk about dying with your boots on. That's my girl, Valeda Snow.
Right. Now, I guess we can talk about, okay, you have such a full wealth of people that you commemorate. I'd like to know about Miss Ethel Waters.
Yeah, well, Ethel Waters, of course, inspired Zora Neale Hurston and basically inspired all of the women who came after her. She was born, and one of the names of, she had two novels, pardon me, two autobiographies that she put together. The first one was called His Eyes on the Sparrow. And sparrows, of course, are little brown birds, they're little dirty things, and people kind of just step on them. If they got cars, they try to run them down and what have you. But she was a sparrow, and she let everybody know she was a sparrow. And she comes to fame singing and dancing. She did the shimmy. She was known as, oh, God, what's the name of that play that girl wrote last year? No. Woody produced it, too. Beth Turner wrote it. I just can't think of the title of it. But anyway, she was a shimmy dancer, and she could sing. And by the time the 20s rolled around, she was the biggest, baddest singer going. She was also the first Beulah on television. She was the first black woman to have her own TV show, if you will, although, of course, it was a white show. But what are you going to do? This is America.
Now, you have a play on Miss Ethel Waters.
I do, but it's never been produced.
Never been produced. Would you like to see it produced?
See it produced. Is that an offer?
Well, I don't think I can have it produced, but I'm sure if we have our listening audience that...
Well, if they're interested, once again, they can take a look at and go to authorhouse.com or go to my website. It might be easier to find out where my books are because the plays are published, some of them, about 32 of them. I have many plays that have not been published or produced, for that matter. Writing has... I've used writing to get away from the world.
Now, talking about the world, our present-day world, who do you think would be worthy of writing about a black history play about today?
A black history play to be written today about someone current. Well, you know, the obvious choice, of course, is President Obama. But, you know, the people have asked me, why don't you write a play about Obama? You know, Obama's not that interesting to me, only because he's a politician. But, of course, he's a very interesting fellow, very bright, very sharp. He's implemented things that people really don't even know about. These conservative Republicans here who are, you know, backtracking like dogs in the night, don't know how to deal with him. This Tea Party revolution that they're talking about is a lot of hokum pokum. What they need to do is get $30 more billion together for jobs and to hire, get these people hired. These people have nothing to do, and they're talking about a class of people that are never, ever going to work. Now, that blows my mind. Because the whole thing about America was, get a job. This is your key to freedom.
Yeah, so you think all of that is worthy of putting it into play in collaboration with Obama and the Tea Party and the Palin?
Well, you know, if it's of interest to you, you should go for it, really. You know, I can't do it all myself.
Yes.
Am I in your way, man? Yeah, I am, aren't I?
That's okay. Are there any other figures today would captivate you about writing about some plays?
The great black plays, is that what you're asking me about, Ronnie?
Yes.
Well, when I was coming through, I guess the greatest black play, well, you know, some of the plays that I've written are small character plays. And as a result, I was influenced by someone who did write a small character play, and that was Philip Hayes Dean, who wrote Paul Robeson, which is such a brilliant play about this icon. I don't think it could ever be reproduced. I mean, he really got into it. He kicked butt all over the place. And I love Philip for it. Philip has written other good plays, too. But Paul Robeson was a play for me. How can you forget For Colored Girls? How can you forget A Raisin in the Sun? How could you forget the Brownsville Ray, Charlie Fuller, going back to him again? Back to Charlie Fuller again. How can you forget the Zoo Man in the Sign? Who else? Well, there's me. But we've talked about some of my gems. Charlie Gordone, No Place to Be Somebody. How can anybody forget about that? Day of Absence by our boy. A soldier's play. The people are prompting me here, and they're right. A soldier's play. Charlie Fuller again. Sam Martin Williams, Home.
Now, could you give us a contrast of plays?
I don't think there's anything on Broadway that I would talk about now.
Not
comfortably, not without cursing and yelling and screaming.
So give us.
Well, I saw this play Race, and I saw it twice because I didn't see it with James Spader the first time, and I like Spader. And I don't know. That's why I'm not giving out my email address, because some people are going to get back to me on this. But I thought that play was so lightweight, I could not believe it. And David Mamet, I like David Mamet's other work. But this was hogwash. And the stage performers are really film performers, TV performers. They don't know how to make the stage. They couldn't even project. I saw it the second time in the mezzanine. I was straining to hear what these guys were saying. You ain't supposed to go to a Broadway play dropping $100, and you got to strain to hear what they're saying. So they're just putting schlock out there. And I'm sorry, David, you know, I'd like to co-author something with you down the road. Maybe we can find something in common. But Race ain't going to be it.
So what message does Race play in things that are in Broadway? And
hey, listen,
the
Race, the way when I've talked to other people in discussion with Race, and some of them have been white, some of the people are saying, you know, this is an ego trip on the part of Mamet. He thought he had something to say, and it turns out he really didn't. It's not about race. He can talk about other things, about interpersonal things and the areas of life that he's familiar with, and you've seen some of that stuff. And some of it is really brilliant. But he couldn't do this for me.
Now, Mr. August Wilson.
Yes, it's hard for me to talk about August Wilson because I have mixed feelings about him, but what do you want to know?
Well, give us a little introduction of Mr. August Wilson and what parts about him. I know you mentioned you have some mixed feelings about him. I don't know if you want to share.
Yeah, well, actually, they're not mixed feelings about him. They're mixed feelings about the plays.
About his plays, his works.
Okay.
Works that you would like to share with us?
For instance, I saw Ma Rainey's Black Bottom Blues in Yale, in New Haven. And it was dense. It was deep. True, I was stoned, but it was still dense and deep. And you wanted to go to sleep, but you also wanted to stay with it. Then I see the White Boys production of it at the Classical Theater of Harlem, and all of a sudden I'm looking at this play and I'm saying, oh, that's what that was about. Oh, that's what that was about. So why are white people able to reveal the innards of this play and black people can't? Lloyd Richards specifically. The play of August that I love is Joe Turner's Come and Gone, because that's a play that's telling me a story. The other things, The Hill, The Pittsburgh stuff, it's all right, you know, but it becomes more kitchen drama for me than other stuff. And I will be perfectly honest with you, I am not a good person to ask about August Wilson because I haven't seen all of it because of my little silly-ass biases. But, you know, everybody's who they are. I am who I am. But I did like Joe Turner's Come and Gone. And I liked the Ma Rainey's Black Bottom when I saw it second time. I really did.
Bubbling Brown Sugar was a very popular
Yeah, that
show
was a big show when I was coming through. That was a big show.
Popular when I was in high school. No.
Yeah.
What did you think about Bubbling Brown Sugar?
I thought Bubbling Brown Sugar was a lot of fun. You know, people like to be bubbly and brown. And come on in. Here's our auditor. We got to find a chair for this gentleman.
Do you like musicals?
Nice to meet you. He's back in here. I'm sorry for that interruption.
Are you into musicals?
Oh, yeah. Juba was a musical, my first professional production. Yeah, I write musicals. Monk was a musical. Monk and Bud was a musical. Ethel Waters was a musical. Hot Snow is a musical. Hot Fingers by Jelly Roll Morton is a musical. Yeah, we're out there with the musicals. We like jazz. As a matter of fact, we're thinking about republishing the plays, the jazz plays, in two different volumes.
Do you feel that our young people today are connected with plays?
You know, we can't look at our young people like they're all of one stock. Our young people, like when we were coming through, some are educated, some ain't. The majority aren't. The majority is still eating lousy food, so they're not getting all of the proteins and all of the benefits of good food that they should be getting. Our society has sorely neglected its populace. I don't want to get carried away with this thing, but when they decided to go to war in Iraq, they really put the stick up the butt. They really did. Because they're still in Iraq. Now they're in Afghanistan. They're spending more than $10 billion a month. And nothing here. When's the last time you were in your car riding on the roads? You still with me, Ronnie?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good.
I'm just letting you express.
Yes, you are. I appreciate that.
Well, talk about your plays that are running in New York City again. So you have a few of them out there. Are they on Broadway
Nothing ever gets to Broadway. Nothing gets to Broadway. Hello?
They are not
interested in promoting shows that deal with black people unless they can totally control it. When August Wilson was alive, he didn't want white directors touching his work. Yet this last thing, which I think was Joe Turner's Come and Gone, come to think of it, was directed by a white fellow. And, of course, you know, he's not here to say, no, honey, don't let him do it. And the wife said, hey, it's money looking good. So I guess that's what she went for. I mean, what is the play good for if it's not to be produced?
Now, are you satisfied with the forums that pretty much run your plays and all?
Say that again, Ronnie.
Are you satisfied with the forums that run your plays?
I'm not satisfied with anything, Ronnie. Okay, I need a new wife too.
Well, I'm sure you have to when you look back on things.
I'm just joking.
You have to have a sense of accomplishment.
Oh, I don't know about any of that, Ronnie. The thing that I think that I appreciate is when I see people look at me and they ask me a question, they actually want me to answer it. I think that's the thing that gets to me. And getting back to, you know, our people need to get educated. They need to stop eating pork. They need to stop eating meat. You're going to get your protein from other sources. But you can't take in all that fat and not expect it to not roil around your heart. And why are more black women dying of breast cancer? What do they say? 1 out of 10 every year comes down with breast cancer? And I still see these little girls eating the potato chips and stuff like that. So they ain't interested in anything I got to say. They gotta look in the mirror and say, hey, I got to change my way. And the only way for them to change the way is for them to, take a look at some of the other models.
Okay, so I think that's pretty good. So do you think
Malcolm, I was told to pitch.
You were told to pitch.
Yeah, and you know who's talking to me, too. Anyway, I've been directing people to my website, and if you go to the website, lawrenceholder.com, that's Lawrence with a U, you'll find 5 volumes of plays in print. If you go to some of the bookstores, you'll see other anthologies where some of my plays appear. But go to the website, and I think you'll see a nice-looking website, and you'll also see a way clear to getting these books.
And that's a U instead of a W.
And don't even mention that other letter. It's a U. So, Ronnie, how long have you guys had the show?
Well, we've been running quite some time, and we've been doing successfully.
Yeah, I know. This is the second time I've been on in a couple of weeks. And I know that the last time I called from my house, they had nothing but static.
We have some very good forums, and mm-hmm. We'd like to thank you for being part of the show tonight.
Oh, well, I thank you, Ronnie, and I thank Leslie, too.
You were a great guest, and I'm sure our audience has... I hope we've captured the essence of Malcolm and some of your works and your illustrious history. And
well, you probably captured the essence of me and not the work. I've been carrying on here like a little chieftain.
Thank you very much, Rodney.
I really do, and I thank Leslie as well, who happens to be here.
Yes.
Anything else you want me to say?
Oh, that's good. I just wanted to say thank you for all the contributions, and we'd like to just thank you to keep up all of the good work. We need pioneers and those of your stature to continue to doing the good work and exposing our young people to the arts.
Well, thank you very much, Rodney. I'm going to go over to my covered wagon now and start beating my way west. Hopefully the whole crowd will follow me. Go west, young people. Go west.
Okay.
All right, buddy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hilder, and...
You're very welcome.
Look forward to having you on some other time also.
Please, thank you.